This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. This week I'm going to be looking at the new films A Walk in the Woods, The Transporter Refueled, Bloodsucking Bastards, and a couple other films like Mistress America, Diary of a Teenage Girl, and Jimmy's Hall, which are all out in limited release in various parts of the country. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, my surefire undeniable box office predictions, and of course, the world-famous DVD roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. That also works for my Instagram, fatguysatthemovies. And finally, if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
There's a relatively slow news week this week, and a lot of that's because we're in the middle of August, September, that split. This is always a very slow time for movies in general. All the summer movies are out, and they've been out, and they're trickling away in the box office. The fall movies, the stuff that we're going to start seeing that's either award films that are slowly coming out, or the big holiday movies are a little bit farther away. And also the good solid October releases where people are ensconced back in school and they want to go have some fun. Those are still several weeks away. We are in a downtime, and it's also a downtime in the industry itself. So not a whole lot of news out there. One that obviously you can't plan. I have to give a big rest in peace to Wes Craven, who is the man behind Freddy Krueger. He created Freddy Krueger and the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise. He's done many other films. He originally did like The Last House on the Left and The Hills Have Eyes, these kind of video nasties from the 70s. But he also had his hand in less horror-related stuff like Music from the Heart. But ultimately, he's best known for his horror movies, including the Scream franchise as well. He was 76 years old, and he died of brain cancer on August 30th. I had the pleasure of interviewing him and his son, Jonathan, when The Hills Have Eyes 2, the remake, came out, 7 or 8 years ago. And, I mean, he's an exceedingly pleasant man. He was very friendly and just very charming and very sweet. And if you ever go and watch New Nightmare, which is, the 6th or 7th Freddy Krueger movie? He plays himself in the movie, and he's exactly like that when I talk to him, which is very sweet. And he's one of those people that has some really intense stuff that he makes movies out of, but just on a personal level, he was just this really nice guy. So it's sad to see Wes Craven go. He will be missed. I recently rewatched all the Freddy Krueger movies at a friend's house, just about a year ago, maybe not even a full year ago. And I didn't even know he was sick. A couple other pieces of news. This one's more event-related. Fathom Events, which is the streaming video service that goes to theaters. In October, they're going to be showing The Hobbit Trilogy Extended Edition, all three movies over the course of about a week in early October. Now, I've seen the first, and I don't know if I saw Smaug's, The Desolation of Smaug in the extended version, but of course we talked about last week how the Battle of the Five Armies is going to be R-rated, so you can see that on the big screen. And I'd love to go to that, I just get so busy in October, I don't even think I can make it to that one. Now, the last piece isn't really even news. It's more a reaction to how the industry now looks at news. Entertainment journalism has changed over the last decade or two decades, really. It used to be there would be like an entertainment spot on the news broadcast on the 6 o'clock news. There would be Entertainment Tonight, which was a TV show. They had Access Hollywood. It was another one that was a daily sort of news magazine show. Really only about a half hour worth of stuff, and half that stuff was features anyways. And if you wanted to get print media, there were a lot of fringe magazines. You get the fringe stuff, and you get these speculative articles, and it was pretty rare to find those. And yeah, you had stuff like Fangoria and Gore Zone and Starlog for the genre fan, but it was relatively hard to get across those because even those were monthly publications. Now all the movie news has moved online, and there's very little life and death involved in movie reviews. I mean, unless you're talking about like a theater shooting, like the Trainwreck screening or the Dark Knight screening several years ago. the news, it's casting news and it's production news and it's nothing that's life or death. It's still just fluff news, no matter how you look at it. All these online publications showed up, and I've written for a bunch of them myself. And they started out as like smaller publications, as a ragtag group of kids, maybe somebody just writing it on their own and then just having some people contribute. Well, they've gotten bigger and they've gotten more traffic and they have to pay for their servers and their bandwidth and all the work that they got to do. And they got to pay their writers. So they've started to put advertising on there. And essentially these have become daily newspapers. And there's a reason why there's never really been, aside from Daily Variety, there really hasn't been very many trade daily publications, but we have them now. And what happened to entertainment news is what happened to broadcast news. Because, you know, 20, 30 years ago, it used to be just, you know, you had the 6 o'clock news broadcast and that was it. And I remember in college, I'd watch headline news and you had about a half hour of real news throughout the day. And half of that was fluff anyway, sports and entertainment. Well, then you got to cable news showing up, and then you need 24 hours of content, which is why there's so much nonsense out there in the news. You're seeing that happen in the entertainment world now. Now everybody's doing clickbait articles, and they're talking about stuff that's not news. A great example is this week there were rumors going around that Steven Spielberg wants to remake Jaws and Back to the Future. Well, and I said to a friend, I'm like, look, wanting to remake and remaking are two totally different things. When there's a script and it's in production, let me know and then I'll be outraged about it. But right now, just because he made a flippant comment at some point doesn't mean anything. People are now writing entire news stories and it's going through the whole entertainment news cycle because somebody had a brain fart in the middle of an interview. The big thing now is think pieces, because there's not enough hard news in the entertainment field to fill the quote unquote pages. So now people are doing think pieces, and now think pieces are getting think pieces written about them. I mean, this week there were two big ones. One was like the Joker. Was he really the hero of the Dark Knight? And then the other one was, is Billy Zabka's character really the hero of the Karate Kid? Which isn't even original. That was a joke from How I Met Your Mother like 3 or 4 years ago. So this wasn't even an original premise. And then I saw a think piece about how these think pieces are bad for the, and I'm just like, it's just stop it right now. So the entertainment journalism is falling apart because there's so many places out there publishing these things and they're fighting for the same readership and they're trying to fill a dozen stories a day that there's not enough news to cover it. And it just has become depressing for me because I like to just talk about the stuff that actually means something. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Couple really quick ones. We've got Knock Knock, which is from Eli Roth. Knock Knock opens October 9th.
We're so sorry to bother you, sir, but my phone got wet and she left hers at her house.
Oh, I'm sorry. But if you want, you can come in and use my phone.
Surprise!
Oh, stop. I can't do this. I'm married.
Yes, you can.
I can't forget this habit. I made a mistake. Go. I'm calling the police.
Hi, Evan.
Look, who's there?
Cheating Evan.
Cheating Evan who?
Cheating eventually gets you killed.
This one is Eli Roth directing it, which apparently he's got The Green Inferno coming out, which has long been delayed because it's about cannibalism and it's extreme. But this looks like a very weirdly typical Eli Roth, let's take a fantasy and take it to a violent degree. The thing that I find odd about this is the three actresses in this, Keanu Reeves is in it, so he doesn't fit this category, but the other three actresses are Chilean. One of them's his wife. Nothing wrong with Chilean actresses, but it's clear he was doing Aftershock, which he shot in Chile, and is using his talent from that. It just seems a little odd. It seems like Woody Allen going and just shooting all his movies in Paris, not to compare Eli Roth to Woody Allen. The next one is Rock the Casbah, opening October 23rd with Bill Murray.
I book tours, dude. Bring this chick. For money. For a ton of money.
To Afghanistan?
Ah! The girl's gone.
What about the show?
Well, I guess the show must go on.
Last night, I heard a girl singing. This has got to be fate.
They are forbidden to sing.
They will kill her and then kill us.
These are the very good guys. We got to help these guys.
I must sing. It is God's will.
I don't think it's going to top St. Vincent from last year. I love St. Vincent. This looks funny enough. What worries me about this one is that it's going to get a little too serious and bog itself down. It's early in the award season. Late October is still a little bit early. This one looks at least mildly entertaining, but I'm not super excited to see it. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Transporter Refueled and Mistress America. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's roll into the movie reviews. Let's gun the engine and drive straight through the movie reviews, rather. Let's start off with The Transporter Refueled. The Transporter franchise is rebooted with a new driver who has to save the life of his father from revenge-seeking prostitutes.
Perhaps we'll work together again in the future.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
The Mediterranean Bank has been robbed before. But never like this.
The driver, he's known as the Transporter. We will make him pay.
May I be of some assistance?
Hello, Frank.
Who is this?
You and your friends took something from me. And I've taken something from you. I'll give you 12 hours to find your father before I kill him.
What is kind of amazing about this movie is it reminds me in a little bit of Hitman Agent 47, which came out a couple weeks ago, which I actually kind of liked. I don't have the same affinity towards this. This movie seems like such an odd release because I don't think anyone was asking for this. If I recall, the first Transporter did well, kind of put Jason Statham on the American map. And the second one was a Looney Tune cartoon. And I remember the third one was just kind of fun, but throwaway. But there hasn't been a Transporter movie for quite a while. I mean, it's been like, what, 7 years? So this one just seems unnecessary. It seems like I never knew anybody who was like, gosh, I wish they'd do another Transporter movie. And I guess I'd heard buzz about this. But then, of course, Statham doesn't want to do it. So they've got this guy, Ed Skrein, who is taking over the role, which he's fine. But he's a little more wiry than Statham. He doesn't have the same, he's not Jason Statham. Not that these movies were huge, massive hits, but Jason Statham kind of was the series. This movie has action, sure. It has car chases, and the car chases are okay. But there was a weird Looney Tunes nature of the Transporter movies, especially the second and third one, where it just got ridiculous. But that was kind of part of the fun, I guess. But this one is, it just feels unnecessary. And it's not anything special for any part of the movie. The action's fine, but it's not great action. That's the thing I liked about Agent 47 is when there were action scenes, they actually had some really cool action scenes in that movie. The rest of the movie was kind of nonsensical, but at least the action scenes were cool. In this one, the whole gist of the story, it's these four prostitutes, these women that are slaves, essentially, in this prostitute ring in the south of France by this Russian crime lord. And they are exacting revenge. They're going after him. And they have this completely elaborate plan that at times quite literally makes no sense. I'm watching this and I'm like, I don't even know how they would plan this, let alone pull it off. There's a lot of dumb in this movie. And I can forgive a lot of dumb in a dumb action movie. Goodness knows I like Agent 47. But this one is just, the characters don't make sense sometimes. The script's so bad that there are random lines of dialogue that makes, there's a scene where a woman, one of them gets shot in the abdomen. And like the next scene, she's just like, oh, holding her. They like have to do home surgery and they patch her up with like sugar and cobwebs. And then the next scene, she's just kind of walking around. Maybe it'll just, oh, you can tell she's a little tender there. I mean, it's ludicrous at this point. And usually that's supposed to be just the main hero, which is, you know, the Transporter, but there's only one good thing in this movie, and that is Ray Stevenson. He plays the Transporter's father, and he's actually really good. I like Ray Stevenson a lot. I think he's a fine actor, and I'd love to see him do more action roles. I got to go back and watch the Punisher movie he was in just because I like him as an actor. I think he's really cool, and he's very charming in this movie. He acts circles around everybody in this film. there are things that happen in this movie that A, are unbelievable that they could happen, and B, don't even make internal logical sense. It's one of those movies that maybe if the filmmaker would have stood behind me while I was watching the movie and about every 4 or 5 minutes just violently shook my head to scramble my brain so I would forget what's happened before, I might be like, oh, pretty, those girls are cute, and there's a car, wow. And that's essentially what they're going for. But it doesn't even hold a candle to the other Transporter movies, which were just goofy, silly, fun, and stupid. This is dumb in a bad way. This is dumb in a character and plot way. And you don't need a rich plot for a movie like this. You just need an excuse to get them in the car and drive. But they try to intricately write this plot, and they keep referencing like Alexandre Dumas and the Three Musketeers, and they're constantly quoting the Three Musketeers. Please, if you're a screenwriter, do not quote classic literature, because you sound like a pretentious D-bag when you do. You got these prostitutes quoting all for one and one for all. And it's like, really? What? Oh, it's not a good movie. The Transporter Refueled sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Mistress America. It's in limited release, and I live in Ohio, and it's in different cities. It was in a couple cities last week. It's in some cities this week. A college freshman in New York City befriends her free-spirited, soon-to-be sister-in-law, only to find herself caught in the drama of her hectic and self-centered life.
Hi, this is Tracy Fishko. I go to college in the city, and my mom said I should call you. My mom is marrying your dad.
Do you want to hang out? Do you know where Times Square is?
She lived exactly how a young woman should live. Who wants to spend her youth well?
Must we document ourselves all the time? Must we?
She did everything and nothing.
You don't know what you're selling. No one will know how to buy it.
What are you selling?
So many things.
Being around her was like being in New York City.
This is directed by Noah Baumbach. Now, his last movie, While We're Young, I thought was okay, but it was very Baumbach whiny. Baumbach is essentially the modern Woody Allen. He often writes stories about New York, take place in New York, and it's about neurotic people with lots of problems. Some of them take place in L.A. And his muse right now is Greta Gerwig, who's adorable. I love Greta Gerwig, by the way. Now, his last film, While We're Young, wasn't that good. But he did Frances Ha, which got a lot of acclaim. But I think that got more acclaim for Greta Gerwig. She co-wrote Frances Ha, and she co-wrote this movie as well. Especially when you compare this to While We're Young and some of his earlier stuff before he met Gerwig. This one has a little bit of like a lighthearted lilt to it, which I think that comes from Gerwig. I think that's Gerwig's influence, and that's what makes the movie appealing. Now, Lola Kirk, who plays the sister, who's like 19 or 20, Greta Gerwig better watch out for her, because he might get a new muse. I have very little respect for directors who sleep with their actresses. I know it happens all the time, but usually when they do, they'll trade them in for a younger model when that one hits 35. Let's see who shows up in his next movie. The biggest problem with this film, well, it's all the neurotic stuff. And if you like Noah Baumbach and you liked Frances Ha and sort of that interaction with the characters, you'll probably love this movie. I didn't like it because the dialogue is very snappy and fast, almost trying to be a little Aaron Sorkin-ish, but they don't quite deliver it well. And part of it's Gerwig. She's not on top of the lines. And I don't know whether it's the way she was directed or because she is too close to the material because she wrote it. Frances Ha was much more of her, I think, in the role. And in this one, she's playing either an extremely exaggerated version of herself or a different character altogether. She's not as warm and fuzzy in this, and she's a little more aloof and mean. And I don't think Gerwig's necessarily like that. At least she doesn't come across in other things that I've seen her in. So some of the dialogue just feels so false when it's delivered. And then it just gets a little shrill at a certain point. It just, like a Woody Allen movie, you just get kind of tired of everybody just neurotically beating each other up and then beating themselves up. So I'm going to have to say, so Mistress America kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for this segment. We got more movie reviews coming up in the next segment, A Walk in the Woods and The Diary of a Teenage Girl.
Oppan Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Oppan Gangnam Style.
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
I'm too sexy for my shirt, too sexy for my shirt, so sexy it hurts.
Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Rolling ahead, let's talk about a couple more movies. A Walk in the Woods, that is not the Disney musical by Stephen Sondheim, although that would have been interesting if they approached it that way. A Walk in the Woods is about a man near the end of his life who decides to walk the Appalachian Trail with a down-and-out friend from his past.
I want to push myself.
You want to hike the Appalachian Trail?
2,000 miles. You have gone mad.
2,000 people a year try to do this. Less than 10% make it.
You are not doing this alone.
Depression is Katz.
Stephen?
Not Stephen Katz.
Good luck. Try not to die, okay?
We go. We go. John Muir once said, sometimes a man just has to get a loaf of bread and throw it into a sack and jump over the back fence.
You okay?
Never better!
I wasn't even aware this movie was coming out. I'm not the target market. Apparently, what's odd enough is it's essentially these two guys. A good chunk of it's these two guys, and it's played by Robert Redford and Nick Nolte on the Appalachian Trail. But the biggest draw for this are older women, like 50 years old and older. So even like older men aren't interested in this movie. Demographic-wise. In a way, this reminds me a little bit of that film, The Big Year, which I actually liked a lot more. But The Big Year was this film about birdwatching, or birding is the... I say birdwatching because if you say birding, most people don't know what it is. But birdwatching is the non-politically correct term. But that's what it was about. It starred Owen Wilson, Steve Martin, and Jack Black. And it was about these three guys in a competition for The Big Year, which is to see who can spot the most birds over the course of a year. And all over the country and all over the planet, really. And that movie was very charming. I mean, just because the actors involved, Owen Wilson and Jack Black and Steve Martin, were all very sweet and charming in the film. The problem is that the movie itself, nobody cares about bird watching except birders. And so there was no target market for this. And it was this neat little story of these guys out in the wilderness dealing with the friendly competition. And it just had no interest to anybody but diehard bird watchers who were out in the field and not seeing movies. This one seems like it'd be a huge interest to people who've tried to walk the Appalachian Trail. I've never done it. It's like, 6,000 miles or something like that. There's no way I'm going to do it. Not anytime soon. But I respect people who do it, and I think it's a neat thing to try. But that's definitely a niche audience. I don't know how many hike it each year, but I'm sure there's at least hundreds, or if not thousands. But it's still a small segment of the population. So it's really more of a character study of these two guys and how they deal with each other. They used to be friends, but they're kind of polar opposites. One's very clean cut and straight laced, and the other one's a big hot mess of an old man. Now, Nick Nolte, I actually enjoyed in this movie. He can sometimes not be good, but if he's in somewhat of a self-deprecating, somewhat humorous role, I think he's actually quite good. I thought he was very funny in this film. Robert Redford, not so much. It was weird because I was looking at the description really quick, and it's based on a true story, so it was about this guy who wrote the book. And when he did this, I think he was in his late 50s or early 60s. It even said so on this Wikipedia that's my go-to source for information these days because I know it's infallible. But Robert Redford is not in his late 50s or early 60s. Robert Redford is 79 years old. Robert Redford is old enough not just to be a grandfather, but to be a great-grandfather. Twice over, if you want to count him, if you're kicking out a new generation every 15 or 20 years. And that's Robert Redford's ego. He did a movie a couple years ago, and it was about this cult. He used to be a member of a cult, and he was on the run. And like, Britt Marling played his daughter or something like that. But he was clearly way too old for that role. And I think Hollywood still wants him because he's Robert Redford. He's a legend. But he's 79 years old. I remember 20-some years ago when almost 25 years ago, when Indecent Proposal came out. That was the one where his character pays Demi Moore $1 million to have sex with her. He was old then. I even remember people going, oh, it's Robert Redford. He's old. And that was like in the early 90s. And he's almost 25 years older now. And he's in this movie, he's married to Emma Thompson, which is equivalent to a guy in his 60s marrying a 20-year-old. I mean, Emma Thompson still looks great for her age. In fact, Nick Nolte looks better at his age than Robert. And Robert Redford's gotten very lumpy. He's an old man. I mean, like an embarrassingly old man trying to play a guy in his probably his early 60s. He's trying to play 15 years younger. He does not look that. Either that or it's a really tough 60 years. And even then, it's he seems to kind of phone in his performance in this movie, which is kind of sad because he's such a revered presence. And it used to be that as Robert Redford would do a movie and it was in a significant film and it was he was a real force in Hollywood. But he's just kind of like just ends up plotching into these movies. And it doesn't seem to be making much of a splash. He's trying to do this sort of witty dialogue with Nick Nolte, and Nick Nolte nails it, but Robert Redford it's like he's not wanting to be there. And it's just boring. I got tired of these guys. I got tired of him. Nick Nolte, I thought, was funny, but it's not enough to save this movie. So this one kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Diary of a Teenage Girl. I'm not a teenage girl, nor have I ever been a teenage girl. But I can watch this movie. Based on the underground comic, a 15-year-old girl has a sexual awakening in 1970s San Francisco.
My name is Minnie Getz. I'm recording this onto a cassette tape because my life has gotten really crazy of late. I had sex today. It feels so good to imagine that he might be thinking about me. I wonder if anybody loves me who I don't know about.
I get distracted sometimes, overwhelmed by my all-consuming thoughts about sex and men.
I don't know what's wrong with you. I think you'd be more into boys.
You have a kind of power, you know. You don't know it yet.
I said, I think, to the publicist, and I've said this on the radio, it's a very daring movie. That's not necessarily a compliment. It's a daring movie because it shows an unflinching, inappropriate sexual life of this girl. And I use that term very specifically. It's an inappropriate sex life this girl has. She's 15 in the movie, and she's having sex with her, I'm assuming 30-something boyfriend of her mother, because she just wants to have sex, and she's like, well, I'm an adult now. And this is not good behavior. And for all that's going around, people, there's a big thing of anti-slut shaming, you know, oh, and there's even a documentary out called Unslut. It's the, let's take the stigma of girls wanting to have sex away. Let's keep a little bit, and not just girls, guys. You should not be running around having sex with anything that moves. I know your 20s and your teens are time to do stupid things, but there are some stupid things you shouldn't be doing, and have some respect for yourself. I'm not in a procreation, not recreation mode, but I'm also saying have a little bit of self-dignity. And part of what I liked about this movie was anybody can look at it and take away whatever they want to. If you want to be, oh, don't slut shame, you can watch this movie and say, look, she's owning her sexuality. You shouldn't slut shame her. Or you could say, look at all the bad behavior she has, the risky behavior, the dangerous behavior, the illegal behavior at times. There's a lot of truth to this. There are people that do this, but this should not be the norm. And God forbid if you have a daughter who's doing this or anyone you know, because this is not good behavior. And it doesn't excuse it. It just is like, well, this is what her life is. And I kind of like that about the movie. It wasn't actually making a moral decision on this. You could take from it what you wanted to take from it. But I have to look at this, the behavior. I mean, at one point, her and her friend, they're at a bar, and they snuck into a bar because they're way too young to be in a bar. And they're like, so they basically prostitute themselves out to these guys at the other end of the bar. And then later, she's like, well, I didn't like how that feels. Let's never do that again. I'm like, why did you do it in the first? I mean, it sort of reminds me of the movie Nymphomaniac, the two-part movie that Lars von Trier did last year, where it doesn't show it as a good thing. It actually says there's a lot of negative consequence to this behavior. There is consequences to your actions. And that's the one thing this movie doesn't show is that there's really no consequence. And yeah, it's San Francisco and yeah, it's the 70s. But there's a lot of truth to it. There's a lot of truth in the way teenage girls think. And I think that's a great revelation in this movie. It's uncomfortable to watch because you basically got this girl and she just wants to have sex with this guy and she keeps wanting to have sex with this guy who could go to jail for this. That's a bad thing to do. People would say, yeah, it's this guy's bad for doing it, but there's some culpability on the girl who pursues him as well. This might be a nice pairing to watch with that Eli Roth movie, Knock Knock. ultimately, I'm going to have to say the Diary of the Teenage Girl kind of rocks because of the truth that's in it and because of the non-judgmental nature it is, not just to the kid, but to the audience members who can take away what they will.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. We've got two more movies to quickly talk about when we come back around, and then the box office and, of course, the world-famous DVD Roundup. Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr, grinding into the final segment with Fat Guys at the Movies. We've got two more movies to talk about. Let's jump right in there. The first one is Bloodsucking Bastards. It opens in limited release. I believe you can also get it on demand. An office worker in a dead-end job begins to suspect the new manager is turning everyone in the office into vampires.
Our goal for this month,
$1 million in sales. And if we don't, we'll be forced to kill all of you.
So you better do what he says.
Max is cleaning house.
We're gonna get this place lean and mean, Theodore.
Is it just me or is this office getting darker? We need your help. The entire office has been turned into
vampires.
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 Vampires, yeah.
Did everybody know but me?
I'm always leery of horror comedies because it can go over the top. There is a fine line to walk. And if I have my druthers, I would rather have it lean more into the horror than into the comedy. Because if you get too far into the comedy, it just becomes a spoof, goofiness. And a spoof's fun. I mean, yeah, Young Frankenstein's essentially a horror comedy. But that's the master. That is the best of the best out there. There's a lot of garbage out there as well. I mean, you can look at, we talk about Wes Craven, you can look at Scream as a horror comedy because it is deconstructing the slasher genre. But Bloodsucking Bastards walks that line perfectly. It manages to be a movie like Office Space, where it's going to really cut close to the bone to a lot of people that are working in a soul-crushing office where the fluorescent lights are bleeding you dry of sanity. The whole point is, you know, they're vampires, so there's a scene, there's a line where he says, well, wait a minute. It's daytime. They're like, yeah, but there's no light in here. It's all artificial. They hide the windows so you don't know their time. They do it to maximize efficiency, but it also is a great place to breed vampires, apparently. When it has the horror moments, it has the horror moments, and it has lots of gore in it. But it's also very, very funny, especially if you've ever worked or are working in an office. It holds a mirror up to that sort of, not corporate life, but to office life. And it doesn't matter what you're doing, whether you work in an office that sells office equipment or a paper company like The Office or your sales company or your telemarketing firm. It doesn't matter. If you work in a cubicle in that sort of that gray, sterile environment with white noise and fluorescent lights, you're going to get a lot out of this movie because it's like Dilbert with teeth. It's a lot of fun. And it also makes some interesting comparisons to vampires and nonsense management is the best way I can say. There are good managers out there, but there's also a lot of managers that spend a lot of time just chasing their own tail and then congratulating themselves. It's a little slow in the beginning, but boy, it really ramps up. And by the time you get to the third act, it is a hoot. So yeah, Bloodsucking Bastards totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
The next one I want to talk about is Jimmy's Hall. In the 1930s, an Irishman returns home from New York to build a community center, only to face resistance from church leaders and the older generation.
Broughton and his crew are communists. They are atheists. So our community faces a choice. Christ or Jimmy Broughton's Hall.
He called us antichrists.
We're in his parish, so he must confront us. And the entire Catholic community are all watching him.
Make no mistake, it's a disaster for the community.
It would be a tragedy if we turned him into a martyr.
Now stand aside!
Christ, any man goes through that gate gets a bullet in the head!
This is about as different from Bloodsucking Bastards as you can get. It's a historical piece, a true story. It examines the culture clash of sort of the modern life of the 30s with the old traditional life, particularly in Ireland at this time. And I give it credit for not being anti-church because, you know, regardless of what your personal religious affiliation is, whether you're Catholic or Protestant or Hindu or Muslim or atheist, it doesn't matter. There are people who are Catholic, and it addresses that. And this is a very real thing to address. And it doesn't say, stupid Catholics, how dare you do this? It's more a generation clash. And we have this always happening all the time where you've got the younger generation doing something, and then the older generation thinks it's too brazen or it's out of control. You get this with the movies of the 50s. You have a ton of those movies where the kids are out racing hot rods and going to, you know, you watch all of them on Mystery Science Theater because they're all these sort of cheesy movies, but stuff like The Beatniks and Daddy-O and Teenage Crime Waves, dealing with the old fashioned old folks in the 50s and 60s. Dealing with the younger generation, and we saw that in the 70s, you know, with the hippie generation, and you see that today with you know, modern hipsters. And this is a cycle, and just because it's taking place in 1932 in Ireland doesn't mean that you can't draw a comparison to modern day, and it's sort of a timeless tale locked in its own time. It's strangely compelling for it being just about a community hall, but it is showing a certain degree of evolution in the culture. So Jimmy's Hall is an interesting movie, not hugely something I'd race out to go see for myself, but it's definitely worth checking out, especially if you like more of these period pieces. So Jimmy's Hall kind of rocks. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. It is a terrible week, couple weeks for the box office. And last week was no exception. No big surprise. Like I said, Straight Outta Compton's going to win for the weekend. My prediction was $13 million. It made $13.133 million. How's that for on the nose? So yeah, Straight Outta Compton won for a third weekend in a row, beating out the big surprise, War Room, which I didn't even cover last week. It's a Christian drama. And the reason I didn't cover it has nothing against the movie or Christian films. It's just it wasn't afforded an opportunity to see. It's an Alex Kendrick movie. He's the guy who did Fireproof and Courageous. He has a very targeted market, and I've seen Fireproof, which was terrible, not for message or anything, but it was just a poorly made movie and didn't exist in any form of reality. And War Room is, you know, if you like Alex Kendrick's stuff, he always releases it in September, and they usually do well. It's always a big surprise hit, but I mean, it made $11 million, which isn't, that's not bad for the amount of money they spent. And they did a lot of targeting marketing to churches and stuff. But, I mean, this isn't exactly Jurassic World numbers. And then Mission Impossible beat out No Escape, which didn't even come close. It made $8 million over the weekend, and it had come out early, and it only made $10 million. Even if it had come out and got all of its money for the five-day into that three-day, it still would have lost to both Straight Outta Compton and War Room. This week, oh, you know what? This is interesting because a lot of people are saying that since Labor Day is always a low time for movies, a lot of people are saying Straight Outta Compton is probably going to win again, which is very likely. I am going to throw my weight behind The Transporter Refueled. I think no one's getting $10 million in the three-day weekend. One of them might be bumped over into the four-day weekend when you take into account Labor Day, but no one's going to get $10 million in the three-day. It's going to be a very low box office. And I'm picking Transporter for no other reason than if it does win the box office, I'm going to look like a genius. So there. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous DVD roundup. Let's kick it off with Mad Max Fury Road. This is a it was a great movie this summer. I didn't have the religious experience a lot of other people did watching this film. But I enjoyed it quite a lot. A lot of fun. It's, you know, a lot of people talk about how, oh, it's a big feminist movie. It's not a feminist movie. It's an exploitation movie is what it is. It always has been. I think that George Miller and some of the people surrounding it latched on the feminist thing because that's a popular thing to say. But look, this is no more of a feminist movie than The Transporter Refueled is. In fact, following the exact same reasons, everything that you say about Furiosa, you can say about the lead prostitute in The Transporter Refueled. But that doesn't change the fact. Mad Max Fury Road's a lot of fun. Definitely check it out. Get it on DVD or Blu-ray. It looks gorgeous. It's got a great view of the apocalypse. Also, if you go to Fat Guys in the Movies, you can see a little video I made of him do-it-yourself Mad Max toy. So you'll have to check that one out. The only other full theater release is Glenn Campbell's I'll Be Me, which is about him with his Alzheimer's battle. An interesting movie, sad movie. But then there's a ton of TV. You've got Castle Season 7, The League Season 6, New Girl Season 4. But the big one I want to point out is Mystery Science Theater 3000. Shout Factory is re-releasing the out-of-print versions of this. Volume 1, which was the first one they released, oh gosh, I don't know, what, 6-7 years ago. And that includes Bloodlust, the 1961. It was actually not a bad little movie. All of these are from Crown International Pictures. It has The Creeping Terror, which is a bonkersly bad movie about a slug eating the entire high school prom. Catalina Caper, which is this goofy sort of fun, silly romp in the 60s. And then The Skydivers, which is a Coleman Francis movie that is so bad and boring. But these are all hilarious. It's weighted a little bit with 3 Mike episodes. And I like Mike. But they're all from that first run from Comedy Central, except that Catalina Caper's from season 2. I think everything else is like season 5 and 6. That is it for the week. I need to leave. Next week, I'm going to be talking about 90 Minutes in Heaven, The Perfect Guy, and The Visit. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.